This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. 50 years ago this week, a group of young activists formed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee during a meeting at Shaw University in Raleigh. Ella Baker was their leader. A few years earlier, she helped organize the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, but she was frustrated by the SCLC's disinterest in young people, and she was inspired by the Greensboro sit-ins. She designed SNCC to be an independent, direct-action organization populated and run by young people. Young people like Julian Bond and John Lewis, each of whom went on to prominent careers in politics and advocacy. SNCC spearheaded the voter registration effort across the South. The organization was also important in the success of the Freedom Rides. This Wednesday through Sunday on the campus of Shaw University in Raleigh, SNCC celebrates its 50th anniversary. There's going to be a conference as well. We're going to broadcast live from Shaw Friday at noon, and we will be joined by a panel of people who live the civil rights movement. First, we're going to take a look at the founding of SNCC with two historians. Seth Koch is coordinator of Oral History Digital Initiatives for the Southern Oral History Program. That's at UNC Chapel Hill in the Center for the Study of the American South. Welcome back, Seth. Good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
William Chafe is the Mary Alice Baldwin Professor of History at Duke University and the author of a number of books. His most recent, The Rise and Fall of the American Century, the United States from 1890 to 2008. Bill Chafe, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Let me stay with you for a minute, Bill. Tell us the story of Ella Baker. You said she is among the most important, if not the most important, civil rights figure in the 20th century.
Well, she's absolutely pivotal. She's a field organizer for the NAACP during the 1930s. She actually creates the NAACP youth chapter in Greensboro in 1943, out of which the four sit-in students get their inspiration. So she is instrumental in all of that, but she is pivotal, of course, in the uptick of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and then in basically giving birth to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee out of Raleigh and her alma mater at Shaw.
And she believed in the power of youth right from the beginning.
She did. She trusted the independence of young people, their aspirations, their ability to make their own decisions. And she wanted to make sure that ability was not taken away from them by elders who would try to shape and control their everyday actions.
Now, Seth, you've got some tape with you from the archive, tape of Ella Baker. She died in 1986. We're going to hear a recording. Tell us when these recordings were made, or the one we're about to hear anyway.
We're about to hear a recording from 1974. So this would have been one of the first, earliest recordings the Southern Oral History Program performed, and it was part of a series of recordings with influential Southern women, and so we were very eager to add her voice to our collection.
So it's 1974 when the recording is made. She's talking about a period now in 1960, so that's about 14 years earlier. And here she's going to talk about SNCC's early relationship with the more prominent black advocacy organizations, the NAACP and SCLC, and her relationship with them.
I think the basic reasons for the reactions of, let's say, NAACP and SCLC to SNCC is the fact that they elected to be independent, and they exercise the independence as only young people or unattached or people who are not caught in a framework of thought can exercise. And they were open. They were open to ideas that would not have been certainly cherished or in some instances tolerated by either the NAACP or SCLC.
I mean, Bill, it was a tense relationship between SNCC and Ella and those two older guard organizations.
It was, because they were mostly top-down organizations, and SCLC was really run by a small group of pastors, and the students clearly wanted to have their own head and to move forward in on their own agenda. Miss Baker, she always was called Miss Baker by everybody, was intent on their being able to have their own social space, their own freedom, their own initiative. And she was instrumental in, first of all, encouraging them to be independent and not become an appendage of SCLC, and secondly, in making it possible for them to both pursue the tactic of voter registration on the one hand and the tactic of direct action protest and sit-ins, et cetera, on the other hand.
I want to talk about both of those, the tactics and the strategy that you pointed to, but talk more about her relationship, because she was an important figure in building the SCLC, as you suggest. She was at one time its acting director, but not its director.
That's correct. Bayard Rustin and Stanley Levison, who were very close to Dr. King, recommended that she be the person put placed in charge. But she had this strange, intense relationship with pastors who were accustomed to basically telling women what to do. And she felt as though the SCLC leadership was too often moderate and temperate. And she at one point talked about Dr. King as being a prophet with feet of clay.
Hmm. Well, and she sensed a very tense relationship with Dr. King. And we're about to hear some tape from the Oral History Collection. But it is interesting that at the time she felt enough independence and, courage on her own to challenge somebody like Dr. King. Let's listen.
But you see, Martin wasn't good at receiving critical questioning. And he was not alone, because this is a pattern with ministers. And to come, see, after all, who was I? I was female, I was old, I didn't have any PhDs, but it didn't bother me. Maybe it should have, I don't know.
This is more than just a woman, though, asserting her independence. I want to get back to the strategy, because she really felt that for the civil rights movement to be successful, it had to be decentralized.
She recognized that, and the problem was that unless you had people in charge of their own movement in local communities, you would not have the energy, the ability to reach out to new people, to recruit, mobilize young people and older people. And the SCLC had not done a very good job of that, frankly, because there was too top-down, and it did not have enough commitment to the grassroots. And SNCC from the get-go was committed to neighborhoods, to people, to communities, to families.
How important was that in the end to the actual success of that movement?
It made it possible for the movement to grow from the bottom up. Bob Moses, who was one of the heroes of SNCC, used to talk about how he organized. He would go in a neighborhood and bounce a ball until a bunch of kids came along, and then the ball would go into a car and other folks would come along, and then he'd ask them what was on their minds, what were the concerns that they had, and that would be the beginnings of people talking to each other ground up about what they needed to do to change their lives.
Seth Koch, in your work with these oral histories of SNCC and other youth organizations in the early days of the movement, have you heard other critical accounts of Dr. King?
They do surface, and they always seem surprising given what we learn about him in middle school and high school. But that sort of critical questioning that Ella Baker mentions in the clip that we just heard was so important to me in defining what SNCC was about. And as Bill was saying, other top-down organizations weren't as open to that kind of questioning. And so when that questioning took place and when those inter-organizational squabbles took place, leaders who were used to not having too many questions asked of them could push back forcefully.
What's interesting, though, Bill, is that while those organizations, again, ministers who aren't used to being told what to do, especially by the women folk, they may not have changed, but the movement was big enough, expansive enough to take in that kind. First of all, to endure the robust debate. It didn't fall apart because of it.
Exactly.
And secondly, it did expand to offer opportunities for these other ideas.
It did. And I think one of the things we should recognize is that Dr. King was actually deeply concerned about the alienation of some of the young people. And there's a great part of Taylor Branch's book, Parting the Waters, where he describes how King stayed up all night long with a bunch of SNCC young people, hearing their complaints about SCLC and its failure to organize from the bottom up. And he listened carefully. So Dr. King was someone who could learn and wanted to learn from all this, but it was a very, very big tent. And SNCC was really there in the front lines, especially in places like Mississippi and Southwest Georgia, where the chances they were taking of their lives was much, much more severe than in some places.
Well, we're going to talk about that, but I want to stay with that notion that it's not just a matter of sort of this cultural preference for men running things top down. There were other very legitimate concerns that King and Ralph Abernathy and others had about what would happen to young people and women on those front lines.
Yes, and I think that was always a major factor. And I think it's also important to recognize how many women were at the heart of the leadership of SNCC. The SNCC was really a place that welcomed the powerful role of women of all ages. And that's important, too, because it's very different from SCLC.
And didn't King also argue that, look, we need a nationally known figure? Somebody has to be a figurehead in a country like this to stand for all of this. And if he said that, how important was that? In other words, did we need these two kinds of efforts.
I think that you probably did from a political point of view. I think that certainly King established that reputation of a charismatic, inspirational leader by virtue of the Montgomery bus boycott and then all the speaking he did across the country in the aftermath thereof. But I think it's really true that you needed both the kind of grassroots activism of SNCC as well as the representational leadership of SCLC.
Seth, it must be wonderful to be in a position like yours to be able to hear all this tape or be in a position that Bill is to do all of the research and read about the absolute complexity of what has been sanitized as a powerful movement.
Exactly. It's remarkable to learn that these people weren't just a bunch of idealists clasping hands and staging these remarkable sit-ins. They were philosophers. They were thinkers. They were religious. They were irreligious. They were arguing, staying up all night, and clashing. And I think, I mean, SNCC really embodies the peak of that kind of argumentation. But as Bill mentioned, it flowed back and forth between the organizations as well, and sometimes heated and sometimes not. But these were thinking people, and they wanted to create thinking people among themselves and among the communities that they were working in.
And those clashes were reflected within SNCC as well, and we'll talk about that as we continue our conversation with historian Seth Koch of UNC, Bill Chafe of Duke, about the history of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. SNCC celebrates its 50th anniversary with a conference at Shaw University this Wednesday through Sunday. That's the 14th through the 18th. We're going to be there on Friday at noon live. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking about SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, founded 50 years ago this week at Shaw University in Raleigh. On Friday, the State of Things will broadcast live from the campus. A celebration and conference is taking place starting Wednesday through Sunday. Today, historians Seth Koch and William Chafe are with us. Seth Koch is the coordinator of the Oral History Digital Initiatives. That's at the Southern Oral History Program at UNC Chapel Hill's Center for the Study of the American South. Bill Chafe, Mary Alice Baldwin Professor of History at Duke, and we were talking about the role of Ella Baker, founder of SNCC at Shaw this week, 50 years ago, her role in bringing young people into the movement and women. Bill, was she successful, or what was her role in bringing a consciousness of women into the black civil rights movement?
Well, she personified leadership, and she actually represented feminism in its purest statement of independence. And I think that she was very effective in working with women in the office as well as in the field. And everyone respected her. Everyone had the sense that when they were in her presence, she was a source of wisdom, of inspiration, and leadership. And that's why they would take her direction when, for example, this whole split between voter registration and direct action protest threatened to divide the entire organization. And they listened to her and said, when she said, these things are really complementary. We can do both. They will reinforce each other. And they heard her.
Was she important in the feminist movement that was beginning to take root at this time?
I think the feminist movement was not something which she was directly involved with as an inspiration. She was personally as an inspirer, but I think she did not become involved in some of those tensions that developed. She really was really more an embodiment and a personification of what feminism was all about, and she exemplified women's leadership.
Let's talk about two other leaders in this movement. One, a young man, a student at the time, John Lewis. Another, an older mentor, James Lawson, who had served in World War II and was helped shepherd the nonviolent revolution into being. What was her relationship with those two men, Lawson and Lewis?
Well, she was a source of great comfort to both of them. I think that James Lawson, of course, really was so inspirational in his discussion about nonviolence at the Shaw meeting. And I think she heard that and understood how critical that philosophy would be to the entire development of the organization. John Lewis was just such a powerful figure who grew up preaching to chickens and who was dedicated to giving his life for civil rights and at whatever cost it would take. And the two of them, I think, also had an ongoing relationship. And, of course, both became pivotal figures. John Lewis as chair of the SNCC for many, many years.
Put this in context for us, because nonviolence as a tactic was controversial and not, you know, part of the original movement. Even Dr. King had to be brought along, and it was a difficult decision for him. At this point, where is Martin Luther King and the SCLC on the whole question of nonviolence?
Well, Dr. King has embraced nonviolence and is preaching about it across the country and basically talking about the gospel and the importance of turning the other cheek and of using the love of one's neighbor to basically overcome separation and sin. James Lawson and John Lewis are the people on the ground who are making that such an integral part of their lives that everything they do is an example of nonviolence. And they are the ones, not that Dr. King was not taking punishment too, but they were the ones who were really putting their bodies in the line.
Was there any sense of division among those people on the ground, people who would later form SNCC and take part in some of the more difficult parts of the campaign, a sense that Dr. King was talking a good talk, but we're walking the walk?
There were always some tensions there. The feeling was that sometimes Dr. King would parachute into a city and take all the publicity, and SNCC had done all the organizing. That was especially true of Albany, Georgia. Lots of tensions there around that. But I think for the most part, there was, there was a growing separation, but there was also an awful lot of respect.
Seth, we can begin to see now, if we've been listening to all of the threads that have we lumped together and call the civil rights movement. We've talked about feminism. There's certainly a question of civil rights for African Americans, and then class issues, which Americans don't like to talk about. I wonder how often it comes up in the archive.
Economic justice, I would say, is a pretty frequent topic. It's actually something that we're focused on right now, attempting to draw more interviews in our collection on that topic. But it does seem that if you follow those threads long enough, you come back to poverty eventually.
Ella Baker certainly knew about it and spoke about it. Let's listen.
There was a period in which there was a kind of a new surge of identity among some of the people who were not class people, but who recognized that there were inevitable links between those who had and those who had not, because any black would be subject to the same treatment.
Bill Chafe, was this also, again, a source of tension within the movement, whether it's about economics or about race?
I think it was less a sense of tension within SNCC than it was within perhaps SCLC. The recognition on the part of SNCC, because of its work with poor people in Mississippi and the Delta, there's always an understanding of the degree to which this was fundamentally an economic issue as well as a racial issue. And I think that the willingness of SNCC to embrace those issues was very instrumental. And, of course, in the aftermath of some of the tensions within SNCC over the Freedom Summer of 1964, which we'll talk about later, I think that the growing recognition that you could not have social change without radical economic change helped to basically create the second stage of SNCC's existence as a much more prophetic and radical organization.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that. Let's talk now directly about what it was that SNCC did once it was organized.
Well, SNCC was organizing voter registration campaigns everywhere, but it was also, by virtue of organizing voter registration, you're going down to the courthouse and you're going to get beaten up for being there. So that becomes the same thing as direct action. When you go to sit in at a restaurant, you're going to be beaten up for being there. So the two issues become very much complementary to each other, as Ella Baker had predicted. I think that one of the things that happens here is that SNCC becomes more and more involved in trying to attract a focused attention on the grievances that black people had over voting, over economic opportunity, over public accommodations, etc. And that really leads to the decision in 1964 to have Northern Volunteers come in to be part of Freedom Summer. And Bob Moses was very aware and very sensitive to the issues, and especially to the fact that he knew that the only time the federal government was really going to pay attention to this whole issue was when white people died. And so he recognized that you had to have white victims, you had to have white volunteers who were ready to give their lives. And that was really the context in which you have the lynching of Chernyshwenyi and Goodman in June of 1964. And then you have the entire fight to organize the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and demand equal representation from the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City. And the fact that the Atlantic City Convention basically says no to the MFDP is instrumental in creating a serious doubt within SNCC as to whether it can ever trust white liberals again.
This is, but it points to the fact that SNCC is really on the ground in dangerous places like Mississippi and taking the blows in order to illustrate precisely what this institution
exactly
of Jim Crow was. And this was the thing that Dr. King worried about, too, was watching people, especially young people, getting beat up, and he wasn't quite sure how the public relations was actually going to play out.
Although there is one moment in Birmingham where the question is Dr. King going to take part in the demonstrations when children are being fire-hosed and police dogs, etc.? And Dr. King goes into the bedroom to pray about it, and he walks out with his overalls on. He's ready to march.
Ready to march. Let's listen. Julian Bond is also a key figure. Tell us, Bill, about his role in the formation of SNCC.
Well, Julian Bond comes from a distinguished family. His dad, Horace Mann Bond, was president of Lincoln University. He's very, very sharp and does a wonderful job of articulating the goals of the movement for a lot of people. He's involved from the get-go. He's director of communications. He is a fantastic spokesperson for the movement. And then, of course, he gets elected to the Georgia State Legislature.
Seth, we're going to listen to a clip of Julian Bond now from the archive. Tell us when this was recorded.
This was recorded by a UNC historian named Elizabeth Gritter in 1999.
So this is 1999, well after the movement. He's looking back and he's remembering his role as communications director. Let's listen to Julian Bond.
Here are all these organizations with overlapping styles, a common or nearly common agenda, but each one proud of its own identity, because this identity is tied to our fundraising efforts. If we participate in a demonstration and no one knows we're there, then we can't say, look at what we did, because no one knows that we did it. So my job, in part, and Mary's job, was to make sure people knew what we were doing.
Yeah.
And in many places, we weren't in actual competition with these groups. We were the only group.
Uh-huh.
But we didn't want people to say, Negroes marched on City Hall in Jackson, Mississippi. We wanted to say, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee organized a march of Negroes on the City Hall in Jackson, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
So people in the North with big checkbooks would say, oh, I like that, let me write a check. So part of it is a fight for organizational identity.
Yes.
And again, you know, just on the surface, people say, gee, why'd you have to do that? Couldn't you all work together in common cause? Well, we were working together in common cause, but we were also, you know, fighting so we could say, we're doing this, these other people are doing that. We don't think what they're doing is bad, but we think what we're doing is good, and we want people to pay attention to it.
It's Julian Bond talking about his role as communications director trying to get attention. So there is a war of ideas, a competition of ideas, but also a competition for money. Did this play a big role in the behind-the-scenes debates?
I think it played some role. Certainly there was a sort of anger on the part of many people in SNCC that SCLC initially had gotten rich off of money came in supporting the student demonstrators, and it came into SCLC rather than to SNCC. At a later point in time, SNCC becomes a very, very dynamic presence. I was in New York City at that point in time, and I would go to fundraisers at the New York Hilton where for SNCC, $100 plate dinners. I was not paying. I was a young person. But there would be 1,000 people there from New York's West Side community, so taken with the courage of SNCC that they wanted to be there to show their solidarity.
So that at some point SNCC did gain a reputation on its own.
Absolutely.
And was building on this. Now, again, the question of, you know, let's all work together. These are complementary strategies. But within the movement, now is there a sense of competition? Almost if they become too successful, SCLC goes out of business.
There is a sense of competition. But it's sort of an underground war taking place. I was in Montgomery in 1965. And James Forman came on our bus to talk to us, and he talked about the fact that they had some problems with the Lord, as they called Dr. King, the Lord, and some of the tactics of Dr. King. But it was a tension that both had negative parts, but it also had some serious dimension of mutual respect.
And that mutual respect, I mean, I'm wondering if that actually built coalitions and propelled the movement, or if the movement succeeded in a sense in spite of those fractions.
Well, I think in the end the tensions become so great that it's impossible to keep them from becoming very vocal and open. But that really has a lot more to do with the failure of the federal government to respond as effectively as it needed to. It has a lot to do with Atlantic City. It has a lot to do with the growing radicalization of SNCC.
You talked earlier about the decision to bring whites into the movement, the Freedom Summer 1964. This was a time, and the theory was, look, until we start seeing whites hurt, nobody's going to pay attention. It was a serious debate. In the end, whites were brought into the movement. Julian Bond talks about that and the importance of it.
the people who wanted white students to come said, the country values white life more than it values black life. So if we bring these white kids down here, and they get beat up, and they get arrested, then the country will pay more attention to what we're doing. The people opposed to it said that's exactly why they shouldn't come. Because we're trying to say to the country, you should value black life as much as white life. Bring these white kids down argues against that. But anyway, the proponents won. White kids came. Now, on top of this, there had always been, throughout history, a strong stream of nationalism in black America. Sometimes it's very strong, sometimes it goes down, but it's always there. And what this says, essentially, is that black people have to do things for themselves, by themselves. Because unless they do, we'll never be strong, and we'll never be independent. And if we depend on help from white allies, then we'll always be weak. We'll always need that kind of help.
So there it is, Julian Bond talking about this tension, which ultimately, Bill, bringing whites into the movement and into SNCC was one of the tensions within the organization that may have proved to help dissolve the group, would you say?
It did both. It helped to precipitate some of the very greatest successes, but it also helped to dissolve the group. And, you know, the fact that those three people were lynched meant for the first time there was significant FBI presence in Mississippi. That made a difference of sorts. On the other hand, the fact that whites were there and too often not maliciously or self-consciously, but acting with a sense of superiority or elitism definitely created a sense of tension that had to be acted out and ultimately led to the decision that there should be a black movement.
And that and the fact that, as Julian Bond talked about, there was always a stream of black nationalism,
yes.
And that was beginning to rise at the time.
And that black nationalism, one of the things we have to learn, I think, is that black power is not the antithesis of civil rights. It is part of the same movement. It was there with Robert Williams and Monroe in 1959, 1960. It's been there all throughout the history of the civil rights movement, and it's really important not to create this binary, this polarization between black power on the one hand and civil rights on the other.
Well, let's investigate that a little more closely. Why did that movement and some of the characters, some of the key figures in the black power movement, Stokely Carmichael, for one, led SNCC in the early years, why would it grow out of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee?
Because the Mississippi Freedom Summer was the place where the tensions became most clear and where some of the differences in simply cultural approach and fundamental understanding were most evident. If people want to read about this, Meridian, the novel by Alice Walker, is a brilliant, brilliant place to start. And there's one story there where Meridian, who is black, and Lynn Rabinowitz, who is white, go to see someone they're trying to get to register to vote. Meridian understands her reluctance and the woman's reluctance and recognizes the need to stay and talk to her for a long time. Lynn says, we got to get you down to the courthouse. It's a northern approach, a white approach versus a southern approach and a black approach.
And I think nothing illustrates more clearly your point that this is not a binary. To see the black power movement emerging out of this nonviolent coordinating committee that started out, that seemed to be on a different path, but in fact wasn't. The seeds were always there. So what happened to SNCC?
Well, SNCC becomes more national as opposed to southern. Stokely Carmichael becomes international, and he's speaking around the world. I don't think that was his intention. I mean, his foundation is Lowndes County, Alabama. But he becomes essentially much more of a magnetic national media figure, and that in turn helps to generate some of the conflict ideologically that takes over, and black power becomes much more the focus of attention rather than organizing people within the South for economic and social change.
So there's a conference this week at Shaw to celebrate the 50th anniversary of SNCC's founding, and part of that conference will focus on where the movement goes from here and the impact that youth still may have in SNCC. Seth, you're going to be there at the conference with the Southern Oral History Program, and you're going to be gathering tape.
We're going to be gathering tape. There's a lot of people there, and there's a lot more stories to be told, and stories not just of fond remembrances of the past, but also, I believe, of hopes for an activist future.
I mean, that is the focus of some of the questions that you'll be asking, is the future.
Certainly, and we want to ask people where they're turning next.
Is there an effort, Bill, to revitalize the spirit of SNCC?
I think there always is whenever you talk about SNCC, there's that effort. And we're very pleased that Duke and UNC can work together on this and both documenting the conference but also being involved in talking to the people who made history.
I want to thank you both for being on the program today, Seth and Bill. Seth Koch is coordinator of the Oral History Digital Initiatives for the Southern Oral History Program at UNC Chapel Hill. It's in the Center for the Study of the American South. Bill Chafe is Mary Alice Baldwin Professor of History at Duke University. State of Things going to broadcast live from the SNCC 50th Anniversary Conference on the campus of Shaw this Friday, April 16th at noon. Coming up next in this hour, a witness in Palestine. We'll talk to Anna Balzer about the conflict in the Middle East. Stay with us.